It's a privilege for us to present the final award of the evening. The films we honor tonight inspired us, touched our emotions, gave us hope and joy, and may even have changed our thinking.
Well, I think that it could be said that our goal in politics is the same as our goal in art, and that's to get to the truth. So that's like in the movies that we honor tonight, that not only entertain us and move us, they show us the increasing diversity in our community and a respect for diversity and freedom all over the world. So, Faye, let's get to the movies.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here are the nominees for Best Picture.
And we all know what happened next. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, nearly 6 months after winning the Oscar for Best Picture in sensational style. We'll talk to the director of Moonlight, Barry Jenkins.
I kind of just took it off the table. I knew, maybe I should say I decided, that there was no way for this film to speak to everything about the experience of being gay or being gay and black.
We'll hear about how Barry's view of his own film evolved as American politics erupted into chaos, and we'll discuss his upcoming adaptation of a novel by James Baldwin. That's all to come on this special edition of The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
And the Academy Award for Best Picture.
You're impossible. Come on.
La La Land.
We lost, by the way, but, you know.
Guys, I'm sorry. No, there's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Moonlight won.
Come on, this is not a joke.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
This is not a joke. Moonlight has won Best Picture. Moonlight, Best Picture.
Thank you.
Very clearly, even in my dreams, this could not be true. But to hell with dreams. I'm done with it, because this is true. Oh, my goodness.
A stunned Barry Jenkins accepts the Oscar for Best Picture for his film, Moonlight, at this year's Academy Awards after La La Land was mistakenly announced. Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. In those few short, though surely rather awkward moments, Barry Jenkins was catapulted to the top of his profession. And it was only his second film. In this special extended interview, Barry Jenkins talks about how Moonlight led him to his long-held personal dream of adapting the work of James Baldwin, and whether winning an Oscar really does change your life.
It's hard to feel it literally in the moment, day to day. Absolutely, there are things that I've always wanted to work on, that I have the ability to work on now, you know, including a script that I wrote at the same time as Moonlight. I adapted a book by James Baldwin called If Bill Street Could Talk, but I adapted it without having the rights. And now the rights are mine. You win an Oscar and the world is your oyster. So I think because I'm still working in the same way, I can't literally feel the difference, but you know, if I'm at a cafe or I'm getting on a plane, because the ending of the Oscars was so loud, I do realize that the world looks at me differently and that there are people who I do not expect to recognize me who recognize me because everything was just so loud at the end of the ceremony.
Yeah, I bet. I can imagine that. That must be the fairly standard response when people come up to you now. It must be, well, I suppose 50% asking you about Moonlight and then the other 50% just asking you about how that particular evening managed to play out in front of your eyes.
It might be more like 75-25, 75 asking about the ceremony and 25 about the film because, you know, many more people watched the Oscars than saw Moonlight. And I will say it's, you know, talk about bittersweetness or a blessing and a curse. I think because of how loud the ending of the ceremony was, there probably were many more people who went out and saw the film after. than who had seen it before. So, you know, all to the good.
Well, as much as I would love to ask you about all the gossipy elements that must have come with that spectacular win at the Oscars, I will fall into the 25% and ask you right now about Moonlight, because, of course, in its original form, it was a play and it had not been produced. You've spoken about how you felt a sort of degree of freedom when you approached that text, though, because you felt that there was enough room for you to maybe give it something new. One thing I think always surprises people when they talk about Moonlight and you as a filmmaker is that you yourself are not gay. The story, of course, comes from a play by Terrell Elvin McCraney, who himself is gay. I think we're so used to seeing this sort of unspoken divide between gay and straight storytelling. So when a gay story does finally make it onto the big screen, there's often this immense amount of pressure that would come with it. We all want it to represent just about everything for all of us. How did that weigh upon you and your decision-making as you approached the story? Because, of course, it's not just a gay story, is it? It's a story about real characters who have real feelings. They take place in this area that you know very well.
I kind of just took it off the table. I knew, maybe I should say I decided, that there was no way for this film to speak to everything about the experience of being gay or being gay and black or being black. You know, it just wasn't going to reach the totality of any one of those experiences. And when I say that I felt a freedom, it was because Terrell Alvin McCraney's life and the life of this character, Chiron, were so alike mine. So just like my experience of growing up in the same place at the same time with a mom going through the same ordeal and with crack cocaine addiction, I could draw from personal experience. You know, the barometer for it, is this right or is that right? You know, I just knew what was appropriate because I had lived many of those things. And I often feel like, you know, because the piece originated not necessarily on the stage, but from the mind of a playwright, there was some visual work or visual freedom that existed within the piece. I got into filmmaking because the possibility of how metaphor could be carried through sound and imagery. And in reading this piece, which was so rich with words, with dialogue, I just saw, again, just an amazing opportunity, the freedom to take this one piece of art that was very at home in one form and just really run with it and see how it could be sort of necessarily embellished, but how it could be transmuted into a totally different form, carrying the same energy, the same themes, the same power, to be honest, but in a different medium. You know, I wrote the first draft in 10 days, man. It was just such a fluid experience.
One of the things that it does so well is that it takes us into this world and allows us to meet these characters in a way that so few films manage to do with such authentic fashion. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the real-life world that Moonlight takes place within, because as I understand it, it was, of course, based on the real neighborhood that both you and the writer Terrell McCraney actually grew up in. I'll be honest, all the way through the film, I actually kept expecting something terrible to happen. I just always was anticipating this sense that something violent or confronting was going to take place in the film. And I was thinking about that to myself as I left the screening and thought perhaps the reason I kept expecting that was that I've seen a number of films that seem to take place in similar sorts of settings, and maybe I'd been conditioned to expect certain things from those stories. So, I mean, this is a poor, fairly rough American neighborhood. But your story is a remarkably gentle story. It's all about sensitive people with feelings. And I came away thinking a key part of the film's resonance comes from the fact that we're presented with these characters who feel so real. Do you feel as though the success of Moonlight perhaps also says something about the wider public's attitude and understanding of this side of America?
I'll talk about just globally. You know, I traveled quite a bit. I spent a lot of time in London with this film. Shout out to Altitude Films. And a lot of time all across Europe, to be honest. One of the best experiences I ever had with this movie was in Berlin. And just how people were willing to cross the distance, the cultural difference, and see themselves in the character. I love that you point out that the movie does take place in this environment where, you know, again, film is a visual medium. There are visual cues. You see certain things begin or certain things set in certain places, and you expect the narrative to have a certain tone, the narrative to progress in a certain way. But I think what's really happening, and this is something that Terrell and I talked about, was the trauma within the emotional trauma that these characters are dealing with, the emotional violence that a kid like Chiron is forced to endure over the course of time, and how that informs the outward appearance of the character, the outward projection of a character's character. I think it is a quite a violent film, but the violence exists on a totally different wavelength than the audience is expecting because of what they associate with certain types of imagery. You know, this is a kid who's roiling beneath the surface over the course of the film, and yet there are very few physically violent outbursts, and the central violent outburst actually is perpetrated by our sweet, sweet main character. So yeah, and it wasn't this thing where we were trying to subvert expectations or counter people's expectations. It was just a fidelity to the life that we lived.
In the film, that main character, he responds to everything that's happening around him by seeking refuge within himself. That's some sort of way to escape what's happening around him. But this is also, of course, as we mentioned, the world that you were born into as well, and yet here you are now an Oscar-winning filmmaker. I know that you initially embarked on a sporting career before pivoting to cinema, but when you think back, can you think of a particular moment that sticks out to you as some sort of big step? So the one that, even if you didn't perhaps realize it at the time, managed to put you on some other sort of track that eventually led you out of the world that you were born into and into something else, maybe of your own making?
It was purely happenstance. You know, there was a teacher I had very, very young in grade school who my grandma would take me fishing. You know, I grew up in the world of Moonlight, which is, you know, it's all asphalt and projects. You know, there are parks, but, you know, even those parks are surrounded by this sort of blighted neighborhood. And we would go out, you know, it's Florida. You can go out to the Everglades. You can go out to the ocean to fish. And I would come back to school, and my teacher would say, oh, you need to write down your weekend trip, because none of the other kids are getting outside of the projects, of the housing projects, and I want you to tell them what that is like. And so it was the first time anybody had one, told me that my story was worth telling, but two, gave me the tools to tell it. And so I began writing at a very young age, but I never the concept of becoming a writer never occurred to me. It wasn't until I was in film school and I had to make my first short film. And I just stumbled into film school. I didn't actually want to be a filmmaker. I was kind of just bopping around. There happened to be a film school there. And it was post 9/11. And I made a short film about an Arab American couple working a laundromat, and they clean American flags for free as an act of patriotism to show the people in the South. I went to college in the American South, that, oh, we're the good Arabs, you know, we're the good Muslims. And to me, it was a translation of what it felt like to be a black man in the South. And just this idea that I could take my experience and I could translate it, I could shape it in a certain way that it would allow me to empathize with people of a completely different culture, a completely different experience, to show that we're all united in this common human experience. You know, we feel things. Once that happened, I was like, oh, I'm done. This is it. I didn't realize it was going to be, you know, just like 2 decades of struggle because you get that first buzz and you guys are going to always be like this. But then you end up on the stage at the Dolby Theater. It's like, okay, I guess all that struggle was worth it.
Yeah, in quite an epic way, it would seem. I think part of the story there has to be a lot about timing. It feels as though so many of the stories that you've told so well have really, they've said something quite specific and quite relevant about the time that they're happening in. And that felt particularly true for Moonlight. It just, even though it was a story that was written some time ago, when it hit screens, it seemed to be just at that specific, perfect time. Does that feel somewhat serendipitous to you?
Completely, man. Because I originally wrote the script in the summer of 2013, and I was hoping to make it. Like, you know, me trying to be maybe a too young person. It's like, oh, I'll make it next year. And granted, I haven't made a movie in like 7 years. I don't have any money. And so it just kept getting pushed down the walk. And I remember, you know, I'll speak openly about it. I remember the movie was in the can. We had just started post. Oscars 2015 happened. And the whole Oscar so white uproar happened. And all I could think, I didn't think that, oh, we're going to win an Oscar because of Oscar so white. What I did think was, it's going to be really hard for this movie to be invisible now. But as far as timing goes, you know, this Moonlight came out of nowhere. You know, I had high hopes for the film. I think what happened was far, far beyond anything I ever could have dreamed or imagined. But once it began, I did realize that we had made a movie that was of the moment. And it was for the moment and of the moment that the time was just right. You know, the opening weekend in the States, walking into the cinema and just seeing the completely broad spectrum of people who had showed up to see this film, it was proof positive that yeah, the time was right.
Many people spoke at the time and are continuing to bring this point up now, that Moonlight really felt as though it was a turning point in black cinema. It was maybe a turning point for queer cinema as well, maybe both of them. But how do you see the current landscape for that sector of filmmaking? Because, of course, politically speaking, things have changed quite a bit in the time since you made Moonlight and it hit cinemas and won the Oscar and so on. The world feels as though it's unrecognizable now. So whether we're talking about gay cinema, black cinema, both, do you feel as though things are changing socially, culturally?
I hope so. And I say that because, you know, I have friends who've made films, and some people who I don't know, who aren't friends, who have made films that are either, you know, in this same framework that you're talking about, LGBTQ cinema, black cinema, Asian cinema, just people of color cinema, you know, people who are underrepresented. And those films are amazing. Some of them are absolutely exceptional, and nobody sees them. And it could have been so easy for Moonlight to have sort of slipped out of the public eye very quickly in the same way. I don't think that there was anything special about Moonlight that fate did not come to pass. And so what I would hope is that, you know, because of the success of the film, both the critical success and the financial success, that maybe, and I'm pretty sure this is happening, I know that, you know, films get funded in a very rigorous way. And that way sometimes is a meritocracy and oftentimes not. But I know that now people can point to our film, you know, as a metric and go, look, this happened with this movie. And I hope, you know, the manifestation of the results that Moonlight garnered will create a lane where more of these films can exist. But it's such a difficult art form, you know. I don't know how movies end up as whole as some of them do, because it's such a magic trick. And I just hope that despite the difficulty and the inherent financial risk involved, more risks are taken so that we can have more films that challenge our notions about what life is and what life ain't and what people are capable of and what they feel.
Still to come, Barry Jenkins discusses his next project and why, for him, adapting the work of James Baldwin fulfills a long-held personal dream. This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned. If you like good films, well, our friends over at Mubi have got an extra special treat for you right now. Mubi is the home of cult, classic, and award-winning cinema, and among the films you'll find playing is The Truth by director Henri-Georges Clouzot, starring Brigitte Bardot in a dark courtroom drama in 1960s Paris. There's also the astounding 2009 science fiction film District 9, which puts a very clever alien spin on the concept of immigration. And a personal favourite of mine, the 1959 adaptation of the classic Tennessee Williams play Suddenly Last Summer, starring Katharine Hepburn, Elizabeth Taylor, and Montgomery Clift. Plus, if you've ever been fascinated, confused, or maybe both, by historical and political complexities surrounding Russia, well, you need to see The Event, a documentary by Sergei Loznitsa that uses found footage to ask what really happened during the collapse of the Soviet Union. The wise people of Mubi carefully curate a rotating list of 30 films, all of them excellent cinema. You will never be caught in that endless scrolling vortex again. Sample a month of Mubi right now for free. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That is MUBI/monocle.
But when you wrote Giovanni's Room a long time ago, that was quite a brave book to bring out, wasn't it? It was about love, but it was about homosexual love, but it was about love. But you deliberately put in homosexual love, presumably.
Well, the boys in the middle. It's not so much about homosexuality at all. It's about what happens to you if you can't love anybody. It doesn't make any difference whether you can't love a woman, can't love a man, if you can't love anybody, you're dangerous. Because you have no way of learning humility. No way of learning that other people suffer. And no way of learning how to use your suffering and theirs to get from one place to another. In short, you fail even the responsibility, which is to love each other.
The great James Baldwin speaking to British television presenter Mavis Nicholson. Baldwin was, of course, the subject of the Academy Award-nominated documentary I Am Not Your Negro last year. We featured its director, Raoul Peck, on episode number 70 of The Cinema Show back in April. The words of Baldwin have inspired generations and, well, even today, it's difficult to find anyone capable of articulating such complexities in such a compelling way. And for Barry Jenkins, the opportunity to adapt the James Baldwin novel, If Beale Street Could Talk, was a dream project that he'd been chasing for quite a long time.
For years, you know, it's Baldwin, you know, which is the be-all, end-all. And also, too, you know, it's talk about a movie that is of the moment. I think the story that he tells in this novel, which is one of his lesser-known works, it's very relevant. I mean, as you said, the world has changed, and now there's just so much going on, so many things that I'm concerned about, that we all are concerned about, both within our shores and I would say around the world. And yet, on the human scale, I think Baldwin, you know, both in his essays and his fiction, was writing about the role we all play in society in sort of hindering, hampering, constricting certain lives and robbing people of their humanity. And then within all that, it's a love story, bruh. I don't know why, but I'm just drawn to these epic love stories that are drawn with these brushstrokes that are very subtle and nuanced and of the heart. And it's just the main character of the book, this woman, Tish, who's this 19-year-old girl living in Harlem. There was just something about her voice that has always grabbed me. When you go through what happened over the last 5 months, there are many different things you can do. I feel very fortunate that I have this very strong barometer that reminds me of exactly what I want to do. And Beale Street is just the bullseye. I mean, the first thing I read of Baldwin was Giovanni's Room, which was probably the first piece of queer literature I ever read, certainly the first piece of queer literature I ever read written by an African-American man. And the next thing I read was The Fire Next Time. And Baldwin, in a certain way, felt like a secret that was kept from me because I never read him in school. You know, I never read him in middle school or in high school. I didn't even really read him in college. Someone recommended, I think a woman I was dating, said, you need to read James Baldwin. And so it just felt like this very precious, very passionate thing that was so a part of being Black in America and also about being fundamentally human in a country that for so long sought to dehumanize the American consciousness, that it's just always been, I talk about barometers, and I might be using that the wrong way, so I'll say a compass. You know, Baldwin's just always served as a compass for me, both as a person, as a human being, and also as an artist. And, you know, he's only been adapted once, ever. So, you know, it's quite a responsibility. But I think the reason for that is the work is just so unbelievably great and important and precious. You know, you talk about pressure and responsibility. You know, it's not about career or expectations or things like that of what you do after you win an Oscar. It's about doing justice to James Baldwin. You know, that's the pressure I feel right now.
I think for me personally, one thing that I noticed about the work of Baldwin is that he's so accessible. It doesn't come across as it being this very large, bigger than Ben-Hur type world that you need to really understand everything about. You can really at any moment pick up a piece of his work and, you know, you can just leap right into it and it's just there for you to savor. Before we finish up, would you mind giving me a bit of an indication on if someone were to ask you, well, where should I start? How can I get into James Baldwin? I know nothing about him. What would your advice be?
I would start with a piece of fiction and a piece of nonfiction. You know, I would start with Giovanni's Room as a very short novel, and then I would read The Fire Next Time. I think those two poles will give you the Baldwin experience. And I think from there, it's just an amazing, amazing well of feeling. I think what you were just saying is exactly what makes Baldwin so great. It's knowledge, but it's feeling, and it's knowledge through feeling, you know? And that to me is what makes Baldwin so potent and why he remains so relevant.
Just before we finish, I wonder if you might talk to me a little bit about how you feel about your own personal journey going forward now, because, I mean, as we've discussed, people have lumped so much pressure, so much expectation upon what Moonlight symbolizes culturally for the realm of filmmaking in all different sectors. For you personally, coming in where you are right now on this epic journey where you've come from such humble beginnings to winning this massive, prestigious award, the top of your profession. How do you feel about your journey so far and where you're heading to next?
The journey so far as a trip, you know, it's a bit easier to look back than it is to look forward. When I look back, I'm just amazed at how, in some ways, just haphazard and random everything was. You know, I made a very small, low-budget film in 2008, and that sort of put me on Plan B's radar and lost contact with them for 6-7 years. And then because of a job, I've worked at this festival, the Telluride Film Festival, since I was like a 21-year-old kid. I introduced the world premiere of 12 Years a Slave and reconnected with Plan B at the moment that I just returned from Europe writing the screenplay for Moonlight. So very haphazard. But, you know, I think the thing about not winning an award for 2 minutes, that's the highest of your profession, and then learning 2 minutes later that you actually did win that award, is that for those 2 minutes, you get really grounded. And when we did not win Best Picture, which wasn't something that was owed to us, I took comfort in the fact that, you know, I was working on Bill Street Could Talk, that I was working on the Underground Railroad. You know, there were all these things that I was so excited to be doing, even in those 2 minutes, when the other film, when La La Land, was read from the stage. And what I see in that is, when we made this film, it is the exact same film as it was when La La Land was set from the stage, and then, of course, when Moonlight was set from the stage. You know, the work itself doesn't change. And so going forward, I try to have my decisions about the work I want to do, the people I associate with, you know, who my friends are, and the movies I want to make, I try to frame it the same way, which is, it's nice having an Oscar. It really is. It's extremely humbling, but it doesn't change who I am, or it certainly doesn't change the quality of the work.
The Academy Award-winning director of Moonlight, Barry Jenkins. If you haven't read the work of James Baldwin, well, please take Barry's advice and pick yourself up a copy of Giovanni's Room right now. Next week, we'll hear from the actor Lambert Wilson about his starring role in The Odyssey, a dramatic retelling of the life of epic adventurer Jacques Cousteau. Today's show was edited and mixed by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolaine Goffin. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.